turn on. You're listening to the radio program about Hackers Places. This air little radio program about Hackers Places.
Good evening. Welcome to Hacktivism Hour on Signal. My name is Walter. We at least have two guests tonight. One of them is Steph from the internet, and the other is Christopher, also from the internet, but also from Telecomics. But first of all, some music.
And I put them on BT. Back on my stolen content up on DVD ROMs. Cause my tips from piracy since I dropped at my mom's. And just because I share my MP3s, they got the government coming after me. Instead of suing kids, why don't you step on up and release a couple albums that don't completely suck? Stop putting DRM on the audio CDs. That don't make it any harder to steal your MP3s. If I want your shit for free, I ain't gonna have to pay. And all your bullshit is why the fuck I say, hack the Gibson, hack the Gibson. I'm seeing BitTorrents like a digital pimp, son.
Fuck the MPAA, fuck the RIAA, fuck the suits behind the PSA, and fuck them all for the DMCA. Fuck the MPAA, fuck the RIAA, fuck the suits behind the PSA, and fuck them all for the DMCA.
Robot pirates, we get our shit for free. Parental advisory, you'll never fucking see. A couple of years since I seen the FBI warning, cut it out, cause that shit is mad boring. Y'all fucking dumber than the bitch from Bad Boys. Step to the bin and it's grandma's sex toys. I'ma just keep filling up my drives, the ones that disappear when the lawsuit arrives. All you fucking suits can suck my balls, and when you get done you gonna make some calls. I better see some changes or it's time to fight. You ain't gonna manage my digital rights.
Fuck the MPAA, fuck the RIAA, fuck the suits behind the PSA, and fuck them all for the DMCA. Fuck the MPAA, fuck the RIAA, fuck the suits behind the PSA, and fuck them all for the DMCA.
Remember when antitrust was the thing? Now you're set up for download and sting. Treating paying customers like criminals. Pens filled up with music nerd animals. Buying off senators left and right. My vote doesn't count in this fucking fight. With a 56K head, hundreds of songs. Drives partitioned like asses and thongs. Now it's gigs of illegal content. If I get caught, I'm joining the convent. What you heard, it's all a scam. If they enter door, burn them in a van.
Fuck the MPAA, fuck the RIAA, fuck the suits behind the PSA, and fuck them all for the DMCA. Fuck the MPAA, fuck the RIAA, fuck the suits behind the PSA, and fuck them all for the DMCA.
Man, let me tell you, the other day, RIAA, they tried to kiss me, man. Then they turn around and try to fuck me in the ass. Those motherfuckers that sold us out like Judas did to Jesus for some, like, some little coins and shit. What the fuck?
They got dollar signs in the fucking eyes, with heads in between politicians' thighs. Fat checks endorsed by senators that lie, pulling fake dollar losses straight out of the sky. And I don't trust trusted computing. They don't just want it around to stop looting. The internet is the only place you're still free. If you disagree, just wait and see. You wanna lock down the web and throw away the key? Well, you better not touch my fucking technology. So back the fuck off or you fucking dead. Yelling 1337 on a motherfucking fed.
Fuck the MPAA, fuck the RIAA, fuck the suits behind the PSA, and fuck them all for the DMCA. Fuck the MPAA, fuck the RIAA, fuck the suits behind the PSA, and fuck them all for the DMCA.
Welcome back to the show. This soothing song was is called Fuck the MPAA, and is brought to you by the futuristic sex robots, and from their album Hotel Coral Essex. I have no idea who they actually are. They're some drunk blokes from the UK, I think. Anyway, we do have a few guests on the show. Christopher, can you introduce yourself a bit?
Yes, my name is Christopher, and I participate in the Telecomics project, which is kind of like a community of people who are hackers and are interested in internet politics. I'm also a writer. I write about new technologies, especially internet, and how they change the political aspects of our lives. So, well, basically, that's it about me.
That's basically also what this show is about. So that's helpful to have you on the show. Steph, could you also introduce yourself a bit?
Hello, I'm a hacker. I do various hacking for freedom things. I do some software sometimes. And I also engage in European digital rights things. I'm also cheering and working somewhat on Digital Rights Watch, for example, and do lots of other things. Ranging from open government data to whatever in the digital rights realm belongs to.
And you forgot to mention that you're from Budapest in Hungary, and that's and that's one of the reasons. I'd like to kick off with our first subject, which is the famous or infamous Hungarian media law. And there was just an analysis published by about that. Can you tell us a bit more about this law?
Okay, so there has been a change of government last year, and this new government has 68% of the vote in the parliament. That means they can change almost, they can change anything they want. And that's what they did in the last year. And one of the things that they did, and the Hungarian government changed a lot, was related to media. And the latest law, which is from the 23rd of December, I guess, it went into effect on the 1st of January, is mostly about three things. First, it is an implementation of a European Audiovisual Media Service Directive, which needs to be implemented all across Europe. Then it tries to extend old media regulation to new media like the internet. It is very imprecise definitions are used, so it's really unclear how much of the internet is affected, but we're quite sure that a great deal is, that at least is in some sense commercial.
What makes you so sure about that?
Well, for commercial services, it says so. But the interpretation of what is a commercial service, that is kind of a gray zone, that it's really hard to decide whether, for example, a hackerspace operating a blog and selling t-shirts falls already under this registration, because this is the third thing that this law is about. Mostly, this is a registration system for all media providers.
And how much of a hassle is this registration obligation?
Well, this registration obligation is, first of all, an administrative process, so you need to apply, you need to submit a lot of data, and there's a registrational fee as well. And the deadline for the registration is like 15 days or something like that. I don't remember it quite well, but it takes some time to register a new publication. But as I said, it's quite unclear how much it affects. For example, the other thing that is really unclear, for me at least, by reading this law is, for example, how much it affects posts by commenters on blogs, for example, who's responsible for censoring them or moderating them or things like that. Yes, so the registration thing is really serious. And this is, you need to register almost any kind of media article that you want to publish. And then the authority has the right, for example, if you publish something that is objectionable to a majority, for example, or a religion or a minority, then it might fine you or it might even suspend you. And in the worst case, it can even deregister you or delete you from the register, and from that point on, you are not allowed to publish anymore. Yes, so this is about most what the law is mostly about. I think from seeing it from inside, for me, it is like a power grab by the current government that wants to have a control, a tight control of analog media.
How much room is
and
there?
How
much room is there for action against it? Is there a is there a constitutional court in Hungary?
Oh yes, there is. But this has been already. There's an issue with this as well. The last time there was something that was challenged in front of the constitutional court. This was about the Hungarian pension system. And I guess, no, it was not about the pension system. Some other issue, I don't know. I don't remember it well. But in the end, the parliament just took away the right to of the constitutional court to judge over this issue. And then they submitted the law again, and the court had no jurisdiction to object to the law, so it went through and everything went on. So that means that even if the constitutional court tries to impede here, it might be sidelined and some new laws might be passed. This has happened already, so I don't know how much it will happen in the future. I have no idea. So it's hard, but the European Union has initiated an investigation into this. They, Mrs. Neelie Kroes, Vice President of the European Union, asked for translation into English of this law, and this has been submitted in the first week of January, and now there's some analysis going on. And since that time, lots of other analysis have come out. For example, the analysis of the OSZE organization is also quite thorough. It's like 57 pages long and very, very detailed.
Well, this is indeed very worrisome. On the other hand, Hungary is a signatory to the European Convention for Human Rights, and based on what you just told me, I feel there may be some snags in there as well.
Yes, I think they are. I have not concentrated too much on general freedom of speech issues. I was more concentrating on from a technology side and how much it affects the internet. And from that side, I must say, our analysis also shows that, for example, it sets up kind of a system that somehow resembles the system in France and also the system in the UK, where you have, like in France, an authority that is able to block or to impose fines. And you have the same co-regulating bodies like you have in Britain, where you don't have an authority anymore where you can go to complain, but you can go directly to the ISP authority, and then they react on that. And what we have is basically a hybrid of these two things. And then the other thing, which is, I think, a new layer, this is, they don't really impose a third-party liability, but they impose an administrative liability, because third-party providers like ISPs or any kind of access provider can be fined for up to 3 million forints if he doesn't help in blocking some kind of content. So this also, and then there's another issue with the law that tries to impose jurisdiction on all media service providers if they are directed at Hungary. So that means also possibly violating the originating country principle of the European Union. So, and even if that doesn't work out, if there's some website outside of the borders of Hungary, they still have the possibility to fine access providers to block the content at the borders or at your source, wherever. So this is quite frightening, but I don't feel yet that this is about copyright or the usual things like child pornography or things like that. this is really, I think, just a side effect in setting up a system that might have these properties if it's needed to. So if ACTA is ratified, it's quite easily implemented, I think.
So Hungary is prepared for the future, basically.
Yes, possibly.
And not so good future anyway. I think it's time for a few minutes of music, and I will get back to Christopher and ask his opinions on this. Just listening to the song Naive, if you want, by Cowboy Zorro from his album Castaway. Cowboy Zorro is from France, and nobody in the studio liked his music, and nobody on IRC liked it either. But the people from Luxembourg thought it could be worse, and I think we can do worse, but we'll see later on. Anyway, we're talking about this new media law in Hungary, so we'll stick to Hungary a bit, but I'd like to hear the Swedish perspective from Chris on this.
Yes, I think that at least the way that I got to know about the developments in Hungary was actually through Swedish blogs that started to report on this upcoming media law a while ago. And then I think that we were quite unaware of the developments in Sweden. But I think it's great that hackers, they communicate a lot, and I got to learn about these things more on the Chaos Communication Congress in Berlin, and where I met Steph, for example. And so I think that once we had decided that we needed to do something, this campaign about the Hungarian, the blackout, once that got started, there was quite many people from the communities all over, at least all over Europe, that wanted to participate in this blackout kind of action or protest. And I think that it's extremely relevant now to focus on...
We may have lost Christopher here. Christopher, can you repeat what you said last?
Okay, so I think the focus on Hungary right now is very important for all of Europe, because since Hungary holds the presidency of the European Union, I think that by clearly demonstrating that the internet is somewhat, you cannot go in and make censorship on the internet, and you cannot start blocking our kind of our blood of life when it comes to information and information sharing. I think it's important to make that very clear now all over the European Union, because we have a similar legislation, or at least legislations that are relating to these problems, for example, with the child pornography filter that Commissioner Cecilia Malmström is trying to enforce all over Europe, to make a compulsory filter list for filtering out child pornography. And I think that it's important to defend now and kind of get all the communities together and do different campaigns and do many campaigns all the time to make sure that we can try to set examples for Europe in general.
Maybe it's worth mentioning that at the European level, lots of these campaigns are coordinated by European Digital Rights, and you can find them on www.edri.org. So that this concludes our commercial break for a few seconds. But on a more serious note, the mandatory internet filtering against child pornography, there was a rather important meeting this week in the European Parliament. Chris, can you give us a bit of an brief overview of what happened there?
I didn't actually know what happened during this meeting. I didn't read up on it, so I'm not sure what the current developments are. I know about this law from previous events, but I unfortunately didn't read about the latest developments.
Well, apparently there was kind of a deadlock situation in the Commission for freedom, security, and fundamental rights, and they currently are in a phase where it's possible to make amendments. There is a compromise on the table which would not make internet filtering not mandatory, but would leave it to the member states to do filtering, which is probably an acceptable compromise, and this might be a good moment to have amendment introduced that any filtering should be by law and not by so-called self-regulation, which is an interesting fashion nowadays in Brussels circles, self-regulation, because that gets this nasty accounts and balances from the parliament out of the way. At least that's my opinion. That's maybe not very objective on this. There's some other stuff on the table, but unless you want to continue discussing Hungary, of course. But I would also like to mention that there is a review of the Data Protection Directive. And for those who don't know what that is about, the Data Protection Directive is from the early 90s or mid 90s. And this is what most privacy laws in Europe are based on. And it's up for a review because it's by now over 15 years old. And it's up for an update. And there will be a massive push from mostly the big systems integrators and the big cloud providers to have its teeth cut off. So Edri is trying to file a input for the consultation round, which ends this Saturday. So if people have strong opinions on this directive, get to the site and help out with that. Is Telecomics in any way involved in that, by the way, Chris?
Pardon? Can you repeat?
I was asking you whether Telecomics is trying to get involved in consultation rounds in Brussels or not.
Concerning data protection,
for example, yes.
With the data, I mean, Telecomics is a lot of people, so I don't have a specific overview, but I think that the data protection bill has been discussed in our channels, and I think that we will make some kind of effort to promote and to kind of do public information about what's going on. So for sure.
Okay, I'll bother you with our input later on, but not during the show then.
Sure.
Some other issues I'd like to talk about. Has any of you followed the situation in Tunisia closely or not?
Yes, a bit.
Well, not really much.
Well, Chris, tell us about it.
Well, I set up a mirror of the videos just the other day, and I think that, there has been some really harsh surveillance and censorship from the government. I think that what's especially scary was the hijacking of Facebook accounts and Twitter accounts, and also the kind of eavesdropping on emails and so on. As far as I understand it, that was made by a malicious JavaScript code that was injected to the browsers of the users. And I think that's kind of the harshest form of internet censorship, when you actually hijack the activists that are trying to get the word out and are trying to coordinate their protests. And that leads to a very, very harsh form of surveillance that we only see in even worse dictatorships such as China or Iran. So, but I think that this this very severe hijacking is now over. And then there was, of course, internet filter lists that were put up. And then we have a really, I think that we saw a very strong reaction from the hacker communities in providing mirrors. I mean, we saw what happened to WikiLeaks during the attacks and the denial of service attacks on their servers, that we had almost, I think, over 2,000 mirrors of the WikiLeaks servers. And similarly, I mean, not as many, but quite a lot of mirrors that were pushing videos that were censored inside Tunisia were made by different hackers and activists around, all around. And so I think, I hope that this will, I mean, first of all, I hope that the violence in the streets will stop, because it's terrible when the police and protesters clash in a violent fashion. But I think also that it's very important to show that it is impossible. I mean, we have the power, we have the knowledges to make the internet almost impossible to censor once these things happen, because we can set up thousands of mirrors and we can make sure to make tunnels that go through their firewalls, and we can equip people with cryptography and different software that will make surveillance much harder. So I hope that Tunisia, as well as, I mean, 2 years ago there was the protests in Tehran in Iran, and I think that hopefully we learn more for every instance of unrest where communications are being targeted. We learn how to do this in a better way, and so yes. I see a positive development. The latest reports I get is that things are going better, and I hope that's true.
Well, I just read that the president has ordered the troops not to use live bullets anymore. So, well, that's a positive development. Not to be shot at with live bullets, but with just rubber bullets and tear gas instead. I think, one question. I mean, Tunisia apparently has learned from Iran by inserting this malicious JavaScript stuff in browsers, using transparent proxies. How could you possibly counter this stuff as a normal end user?
For an end user that is not really that, doesn't know that much about computers, it's really hard, because I think that with security in harsh environments like this, it's very hard, because the simple solutions are usually not very safe, and the safe solutions are usually quite hard to use. I mean, so I think that one thing that works pretty well is to distribute VPN tunnels. And so if you're a hacker and you know how to set up a VPN tunnel on your home computer, you can actually help out a few people with something that is quite easy to use. Second, I think that one good strategy is to encourage people to use the Firefox browser with good plugins that are securing your web browser. For example, the NoScript plugin and also the HTTPS Everywhere plugin, where you, well, it's not perfect security, of course, but it is at least something that makes your browser much safer, because I think that's the most common point of attack for these scripts that the government is distributing. But then again, I mean, I see it also in the long term, it's great to have people using, for example, the Tor network, because then you can set up hidden destinations, hidden services, and you then it's very hard to censor that kind of traffic. So I think that it, like you have to work on as things happen. I mean, you have tried to distribute knowledges and softwares that do their job right now. But I think in general, we need to kind of learn how to make people more aware of computer security, because it's a long-term project. And I mean, it's easy for somebody who knows computers to go into almost any environment and make cryptographic tunnels and set up different solutions. But for the average user, it's especially when the average user is under a lot of stress and there is maybe the police is, you know, two blocks away, then you don't really know what to do and you don't have the time to learn and experiment with these softwares. So I think that both ways, both the long-term and the short-term solution is something that we should work on. And I mean, it does work. Once you get people to use it, it usually works, because the governments, they are fortunately, I mean, the internet functions that way, that, I mean, if you know how to work your way around a network environment, it's almost impossible to stop the flow of information without, I mean, cutting the cables. We see this in, for example, Burma and North Korea, these extreme dictatorships. There, the government has the power to actually physically switch off the fiber cables going in and out of the country. And but that is very rare. So I think that learning how to work your way around a harsh network environment can provide information that is crucial to the outer world.
Steph, what are your thoughts on this?
I think that technology in these regions of the world is exactly the same technology as it is here. And it really works well, and I think that there are solutions for accessing these networks, like Tor networks and stuff like that. It's the same image that you have to download and install, and I don't think that people are not smart enough to do that. We need to do more evangelizing and we need to do more awareness raising, that is true, but I think the key people know already. And it's like with, if for example, remember the dead CSS fiasco when we could finally watch DVDs. You just needed to have one smart guy in the whole world and then everyone could copy. And I think these smart guys are everywhere. In every country there are people. You just need to find them and encourage them to do some more awareness work, I think.
Okay. Thank you so far. Before we get to some music again, I'll just explain to the listener why the sounds may all be a bit different. We are having a virtual studio here. We're actually not in the same studio, all three of us. I'm sitting in The Hague, Steph in Budapest, and Chris is somewhere in Sweden. I don't even know where, actually. Chris, where are you in Sweden?
I'm in Gothenburg, the second largest city on the west coast.
Okay, well, basically, it's a distributed studio as it is, or a distributed virtual studio, if you can make it any more hip. But now, some music.
Computers, invaders,
Okay, you just heard Computer Invader 1 Target User by Kaonix from it, or him or her album When Silicium Cry. And that was followed by Isundo by Galson from the album Musical Landscapes 1, which is excellent lounge, lift or elevator or waiting music. There's loads of stuff like that, by the way, on Jamenda.com. Anyway, back to our virtual studio guests. Chris, you mentioned using Tor, the Onion Routing project, as a tool for dissidents in the politically oppressive regimes. But we just had a case in our hackerspace of a member of ours who has been who's now officially prosecuted by the police, and he's considered a potential pedophile because someone used his Tor exit node to upload child pornography.
That's terrible. I have heard similar cases about child porn and exit nodes, and that it's a very complicated phenomena. I think partially because the courts don't know enough about how what a Tor exit node does. I mean, the Tor exit node, the person setting up a Tor exit node has no clue to what the traffic will be in his or her exit node. And usually these exit nodes, I mean, the large ones are in data centers. And then there comes a notice or a police investigation because there has been an IP number in there. And then I think that the courts don't know technology well enough to realize that this is a part of a network infrastructure. It's it has no, it never looks into the traffic. It's impossible to trace back where what the source of the traffic is. And so I think that we need to educate the world about what how a dark net works. And so I think that if that is done, then you have at least the first steps in preventing these accusations.
Well, the interesting bit is this is not even before the court, but apparently the police has been unable so far to read the LVM volume of his Linux machine, which has been confiscated 2 years ago or something like that. So in terms of cluefulness, it's not only the courts which may have a problem. Steph, you may have some opinions on this as well, I suppose.
I do, sure I do. I can say that you can avoid the problem of exit nodes if you do not exit the Tor network. That is what Onion networks are good for, and the Onion top-level domain, if you want to say so. This is really great stuff because you enter the Tor network at your own host, so really you cannot be tracked in this regard. And then you don't exit the Tor network at all because the service that you are accessing is inside on one of the nodes. So this is really exciting stuff because only the server node himself can do minimal tracking, but even he cannot do because it's a Tor node himself, so he doesn't know where the traffic comes from really. And if you go to explore the Onion networks, you will find a lot of things there already. There are wikis, there you have chat applications, you have file exchanges. So even if you're looking, for example, for a dead drop, you can safely go to an Onion network and you find a lot of dead drops where you absolutely anonymously can upload some data and then someone else can retrieve it somewhere, and you never need to know each other. So I think this is really an exciting opportunity, and we need to provide more services in the Onion network itself.
Steph, allow me to scare you a little more.
Do that, please.
Well, you probably don't want it. Last December, a report on behavior characteristics of cyber criminals was released, and the main author is a professor at a police academy in the Netherlands, which actually, given the quality of that report, may fit in the film series Police Academy quite rather well. But one of the remarks made in that report was that a typical suspect behavior of pedophiles was using ways to conceal their IP addresses, such as VPNs. And another typical pedophile trait, by the way, was being in your 30s and still living with your mom at home. But
VPN illegitimization is kind of stupid because a lot of the industry is relying on VPNs, and lots of home working professionals are relying on VPN. So I think this is really going against the industry as well.
There was a bit of a riot on the Dutch part of the internet about that report, and it's probably being pulled back, etc. But nonetheless, someone in the position of being a professor at the police academy thinks that using a VPN already is suspect behavior. And is apparently teaching that to coming detectives and policemen.
That's very bad, I think. But then again, I think it's a matter of education. I mean, if we tell the world that, I mean, this is crucial for business and industry, it has to be there. VPN is extremely important to them. And then you have the VPN services have really been very because of the file sharing laws and so on. So people are using them for even BitTorrent traffic. And educating people how these technologies work.
Yeah, but the VPN bit is probably going away, but using the Onion router or Freenet or GNUnet, actually, I never quite understood why people are so happy about Tor and don't want to use Freenet or GNUnet, but you can educate me on that as well. It's probably going to be considered suspicious behavior even more than using a VPN, because, as Steph said, loads of professionals use VPNs to work from home. Most people I know actually use them, so that's being considered ridiculous. I hardly know anyone who's having a Tor node.
I am one of those, you know.
But you're special, Steph.
You need a Tor node for operating Tor services, you know.
Yeah, but you're special, Steph.
We should have more Tor nodes. We should encourage everyone who hears this and beyond that to install as many Tor nodes as possible.
Isn't it time for having a nice killer application with Tor, like FTD over Tor?
FTD? What is FTD?
That's a wonderful tool which tells you what kind of stuff is on Usenet available on Usenet.
Oh, cool.
Which may not necessarily be held in a favorable opinion by the MPWA and etc. But it may result in interesting experiments in the limits of copyright law for you.
I think this is already given. There are really nice file exchange sites in the Onion network. And if you are willing to compromise on some of your anonymity, which I would not recommend you, because setting up a Tor proxy on your own host is really not that difficult if you're on a sensible operating system, then you can use, for example, tor2web.org. Where you can access nodes in the Tor network or services in the Tor network from a simple web browser. You don't have to install anything, which I advise against again, but it is possible to give links out to people outside the network.
Yeah, I was a bit joking about the copyright infringement stuff, but I think as long as you don't have a legitimate application, which lots of people want to have, this is going to remain a fringe phenomenon.
Possibly currency-related things can happen in this sphere as well. Of course, this would make it a big target also.
Okay. Chris, any thoughts of you on this? Silence. Time for music then, I'm afraid. Well, we do have some...
Faithful.
Okay, you just listened to the song Beautiful Girl by Baby Paul from his album Mood Swings. He's from France. And then we were followed by a German act. It's called Tetlap from their album Analysieren und Besser Machen, the song Hard One. And back to the studio, we managed to get Chris online again. We had some technical difficulties because this famous open source operating system Linux crashes all the time when you do sound with it. I'm hereby asking for a Windows-only studio. Anyway, we got an interesting question on IRC, on the channel Hackerspace Signal on irc.freenode.net. And Steve, who's supposed to be at work, but nonetheless had time to ask us this question on IRC, he was wondering how many rogue exit nodes are there in the Tor network, and how many of them actually snoop into the exit traffic, etc. Does any one of you have an educated opinion on that question?
No, I don't know how many or to what extent. I've just heard reports about there being exit nodes that are actually monitoring the traffic that is going out. So I think that the important thing is to never send passwords or anything unencrypted over the Tor network, because I mean, once you go through the exit node, you're open in the plain text internet, and then you are exposed again to the danger. So that could be like a false security that will put you to risk.
Okay, Steph?
Yes, especially injection. So if someone is operating a Tor exit node, it's not only that he can listen into the exit node, but he can also inject some data. Like, for example, in Tunisia, they did the JavaScript. And by injecting the JavaScript, they can determine your identity, possibly, because it can expose your IP address and things like that, possibly. So sending unencrypted traffic over a Tor node is not a good idea. Yes, that is definitely true. But the other thing is that what I referred to already earlier is, if you do not exit the network, you don't have this problem at all. And that is why Onion network is so cool, because you don't have this problem. You're not exiting and not going into normal unencrypted internet band.
Okay, interesting.
Yes, and the same goes for the I2P darknet, which I find very interesting as well. Instead of having .onion sites, you have .i2p sites. And as long as you stay inside the darknet, you're much safer, because then you have end-to-end encryption all the time, and you never go out where somebody can listen in and determine your real IP number.
And what does ITP stand for, and how does that technology work?
ITP is similar to Tor, but it's a different type of software, and you don't have the divisions between a client, a relay, and an exit node as you have in Tor, where you have multiple purposes of the software. Instead, you just have one ITP router, which is the same software for all platforms. And it's basically a darknet providing different services, such as web, and you have IRC. You can do SSH over I2P, and you can do distributed emailing, and you also can do some instant messaging chat. So it's basically an overlay protocol that rides on top of the TCP/IP infrastructure, and it provides almost a complete network on top of the internet. So it's quite similar to the way that the hidden services and the .onion destinations work in Tor, but you have something called local destinations instead in I2P. So the software you install contains all the different services that you need. So you can set up, it has a built-in HTTPD. So you can set up a site inside the ITP darknet very easily. And it's a bit different, but it's also very similar. The basic principle is similar, but the functioning is a bit
And how safe is it?
I don't know. Safety is a strange concept. How safe is something? It's safe in the sense that you have onion routing similar to Tor, which makes it very hard to determine where you are in the world. And then it features multiple encryption on top of on your traffic. So your traffic is constantly encrypted. And I would say that compared to the .onion sites in Tor, the .itp sites are of similar architecture. But then again, ITP is much younger and it's a much smaller community of people working with it. Tor is a big project, I would say. So they're different in that respect. And I couldn't say which one is safer or which one is less safe. I think that you can study the whole specification of the ITP software at i2p2.de, where you also can download the software and the source. It's a public domain. So.
Okay. Anyway, I think it's time to move on a little bit from alternative network designs to the political sphere again. Mm-hmm. Have any of you guys seen the presentation on the last CCC Congress on the data retention review?
Sure.
Well, that makes you an expert, Steph. Tell us about it.
I'm not really an expert. Those people on stage were much more an expert, and I guess you were their archangel and very much knowledgeable about the topic. Is that right? You were the archangel, were you?
I was the archangel, but I try not to be the one talking during the show.
Okay. So there's going to be a review on the data retention directive, and this is really, really important for everyone all across Europe, especially. The problem is we don't have much data. Much of the member states did not send data. The data itself is very inaccurate, so I think there was even a consultation that was almost cancelled because of lack of data. But please correct me if I'm making things up. I'm not really so knowledgeable about the topic.
The European Commission expressed disappointment about the low quality of the data provided by the Dutch government.
Oh, just by the Dutch government?
Yes. Yeah, my perspective is fairly...
I don't know. I think I heard some figures like only 13 member states submitted any kind of data.
Quite a few member states haven't even implemented the directive yet. I mean, Sweden hasn't implemented
it. That's three, I guess. It's Luxembourg, Sweden, and I don't know who's the third one.
So, but basically for the listeners who don't know this, the Data Retention Directive is a directive by the European Union which says that there is a mandatory minimum term during which data has to be retained about telephone traffic, but also about internet traffic. Especially the internet part is really poorly thought out because I've read it about 6 times and I still don't get at which level the ISPs have to retain traffic data. But nonetheless, it's mandatory. The Romanian Constitutional Court has ruled the Romanian implementation unconstitutional, and so has the German Constitutional Court last May, I think. And Sweden and Luxembourg and a third country, which I forgot, have refused to implement the directive so far. And at least Sweden is being taken to the European Court by the European Commission over this. So it's a bloody political mess, and this upcoming review may be a chance to put this awful cat back into the bag. Anyway, I'm about to plug Edry.org again, so Edry will be involved in that. There is a special mailing list for that being started up. Right now, the three Edry members, because Edry is nothing but it's local members, which are more or less in charge of this project, are Bits of Freedom in the Netherlands, AK Voorraadspraak in Germany, and Panopticon in Poland. But we really, really need people from other countries, especially Eastern European countries, but also relatively small member states such as Luxembourg, Malta, etc. Because the lobby in Germany is strong, but Germany is, well, just Germany. No offense to our German listeners. But at the European level, the European community is so large, you really need people from especially the newer member states on this. And unless Chris has something to say on this as well, we're going to get some music again.
Well, I can say that Sweden is still haven't implemented it, mm-hmm. and we have been delayed for quite a while. There is a political majority in Sweden that really wants to implement it. But there is, of course, a quite strong resistance. People are very skeptical, and there are some people making a lot of noise about not implementing this. And I think that we will see in the coming weeks or months what the final decision will be, because we have been on hold for such a long time now that we will soon be fined once again for not implementing it. And so we will see. It's very crucial, this review, what it will say and how things will turn out in just the coming weeks.
Well, I have no idea what will be happening, actually. But we're sure living interesting times to talk about the Chinese curse.
Yeah. We'll be right back.
and you just listened to Borg Boogie by the Diablo Swing Orchestra, which was by special request of Steph, who thought all our previous music was crap. Well, Steph, your taste in music is incredibly mainstream because this is the most popular song on Jamendo for ages. And that song was preceded by the song Vienna by the Offenbach Project from the album Delicus. Well, it's either a typo or... it says Delicious or Delicious, but I think it should have been Delicious, but nonetheless. It's their album, their name, their typo, whatever it is. It was the Offenbach Project. And I have no idea where they're from. I forgot.
Regarding the data retention directive.
I thought you were going to defend your taste in music, Steph.
No. I don't really care about tastes. I really recognize that everyone has its own. But still, I can voice whenever I don't like something. I reserve that right for me. So regarding the data retention directive, I think it is really easy for most of us hackers to have access to our own data or even our own companies and make up some anonymized visualizations based on that to show how frightening even the data in the data retention directive is, what kind of data you can data mine from that. I think that this is a really exciting project, and if there are some hackers listening in looking for some interesting project, I think this is one of those. You can see some really small seeds of that if you use Mozilla Thunderbird, which shows you all kinds of statistics already with your peers. But you can data mine much, much more data out of this. You can, I did this myself. I have a project on GitHub for visualizing, but I will never release my own data or even visualizations based on that, because I just saw things that I don't want to be out in the open, even if they are retained already by the authorities. I think this is really an exciting project, and if we can show that to a wide audience, we might improve our reach.
A bit like the EFF's unique browser project, you mean?
I don't know that, please.
EFF has a project going on which is trying to figure out... it's called, I think actually called Unique Browser, but I have to look it up. I'm doing this off the cuff. But they have a site, when you visit it, it tells you how unique your browser OS...
Panopticlick.
Yeah, Panopticlick project. Yeah, that was it. And actually, a bunch of Dutch hackers started another project lately after the speech at CCC on the GSM hack, because those web-to-HLR gateways for GSMs are so cheap. 2 eurocents per request, or even less than that. And they're working on, but they haven't finished yet, because the data they get from the HLRs, the Dutch HLRs, is not that useful yet, is to actively follow some politician's GSM's location. Because if you can get the data out of the HLRs of the GSM network for, well, not for free, but rather cheaply, you can just survey, put some politician in surveillance.
Yes, and you can even track them using passenger name records when they are traveling and switching off their mobile phones.
No, this was purely...
Yeah, that's a different topic. I'm sorry for mixing that in.
Yeah. Well, if you want to talk about passenger name records, then feel free to do so. I'm not an expert on that subject. Well, not on any subject whatsoever.
No, me neither, but passenger name records are a very similar threat, like... for tracking GSM phones. I think this can be easily done now, as shown, but it's similarly easy to track your travels if you're using a travel agency, if you're using normal airplane companies, not low-cost carriers, then most of the data is being sent via 4 big data warehouses, which are interconnected. And anyone who's operating a travel agency can basically access this data without any access locks being made or any kind of access controls being in place. This is a really fun system. This predates the internet, and it is even less protected than originally the internet was for such purposes. So And basically, it's unprotected because you need to have a dump terminal in every travel agency, because you cannot expect anyone going in a hotel and say, this is the password to my data or something, so you can access it. So that means that this whole system is quite open, and you can track hotel room reservations, flight reservations, train, car reservations, and all that stuff if you do it via travel agency.
Provided that people have booked through a travel agency, or is that just shared and stored?
Yes. Apparently, for example, low-cost carriers, which do 40% of the traffic in Europe, are not connected to the system.
Okay, that makes me slightly less scared than I already am. I want to bring up another subject, which was postponing a bit, since the EFF might join the chat, but apparently everyone is too busy, which is too bad. The subpoenas of Twitter in the United States, have you heard about that?
Yes.
And yeah, since at least one of you is at least tangentially involved in the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative, you may have a bit of opinion on that.
I think it's very interesting that Birgitta Jonsdottir who is also an Icelandic member of parliament, is involved in this case, because then that means it will be a high profile case. I mean, of course, anything WikiLeaks nowadays is reported everywhere in the headlines of all the news media. But I think it's important to get a person, a well-respected European citizen, to actually be a target. I mean, it's a good thing, but even though it's a very bad thing. So I hope that this will bring some pressure to all of this process to be fair and just. And also, I think that this can put some thrust on how we think about data protection in Europe. Because, and also I think that, I mean, the more important issue here is not so much the legal process, because the way I understand it, it's a criminal investigation, and it's Twitter is a American-based company, and so I think that the legal process here is nothing but I mean, it's strange, but it's still according to the book. But I think that the issue of where we host our data, I mean, physically, in which country is my personal data, is being highlighted in a very interesting way. So we have been, the average user is so dependent on services that are based in the United States. We use Google, we use Facebook, we use Twitter, and all of these services are on US soil. So they are very vulnerable. And I hope that people will consider what the effects of these large centralized services are to our personal data. We collect so much in a few server halls, which of course are gigantic. The data centers of the United States are huge, but still, all of our data is in there, and we have to consider seriously now the alternatives. I mean, Twitter has a fully functional replacement, which is the StatusNet software. It's the instance that is most famous here is the Identica instance. But for example, Telecomix, we have set up our own instance of the StatusNet software. It's available to anyone on status.telecomix.org. And I think that by showing that we can actually distribute and decentralize the social media that we are using every day, and make it less vulnerable to these types of attacks.
Does it run on Tor?
If it runs on Tor,
yeah.
You can access it on an exit node. Of course, it has HTTPS, so you will be end-to-end encrypted. As far as I know, we haven't set it up in as a hidden service yet. But that's quite easy to do. I mean, the Tor hidden to make a hidden service is quite easy in Tor. You just kind of configure the software to listen in on a port.
Yeah.
But yeah, That's a great idea to make. You can do this with all your services to have darknet access. For example, our IRC network has both Tor and I2P connections, which is IRC is very easy to configure to run over the darknets. So,
hey, we are about to be joined by a different guest in our virtual studio.
Great.
Brenno de Winter, who's a freelance journalist, and he spoke to one of the Dutch targets of this Twitter subpoena. And well, Brenno, what was Rob's reaction to it?
Well, what we've seen in the media is that Rob basically stated very clearly that he is not involved in WikiLeaks, and that it is kind of strange all in all. And what he pointed out is exactly the same point that was just made. And that is that it shows why centralized services are a big issue. He literally told me that that he had a problem explaining why he wasn't using Gmail. And on Saturday he said, as of today, that's a little bit easier to explain now.
Yeah, by the way, for the listeners who don't know, we were talking about Rob Gongrijp. One of the founders of Dutch ISP Access for All, and also the speaker of the keynote speech on the CCC Congress, was one of the other targets of the Twitter subpoenas. Allow me to play the devil's advocate for a bit. I mean, what's the big deal? I mean, they're using an American web service, which is in an American jurisdiction, and apparently in an American law, as part of a prosecution, they can ask data from ISPs, and as far as I can see, Twitter has gone out of its way to tell people about this and should be lauded for this. What's so wrong about this?
Who are you asking? Are you asking me?
Well, anyone who wants a response, but feel free, Brenno. You know, we know you love to talk.
Well, of course, with doing a criminal investigation in itself is nothing wrong. But the thing is that Rob doesn't know what he is suspected of. He doesn't even know if he is a suspect at all, or if this is in the case of Julian Assange. And it only shows that how far they are willing to go. What is wrong here is that apparently they are measuring by double standards. For me as a journalist, it's kind of amazing to see that on one hand, the US applauds using technologies to be freedom loving as you can, and as very forthcoming for the First Amendment. But when they are themselves involved, all of a sudden they apparently have a different standard. So yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned it, because there's a certain irony in there that the Tor project has been mostly funded by the United States government so far.
Exactly. You know, it's very double standards. So that's one of the things that's wrong.
I think Steph wants to say something as well.
Yeah, I think that we should really also focus on solutions. And I think Trisk did mention two really important things. One was StatusNet, and the other thing that he really touched upon just shortly, and I think this brings us back to the Data Protection Directive, is that we have some good standards in Europe yet. And we should really insist on those. Because without those, it will be much harder to do StatusNet also in Europe.
I would say, Steph, honestly, and I'm deeply cynical about this. For example, in the Dutch situation, you have this centralized database, or not centralized, well, central administrative body, which does all the requests for traffic data as part of the Dutch implementation of the Data Retention Directive. And they're processing hundreds of thousands of requests each year. I'm living in the country with the highest number of phone taps per capita, probably in the world.
No, good to hear.
Yeah.
And welcome all the guys in the line then. Hi.
Yes. Hi, guys. So basically, I would almost feel more my privacy is probably more better guarded in the United States. To just play devil's advocate again, because people are at least telling me that I am part of a prosecutorial investigation.
Yes, well, that is only the criminal prosecution. The wiretaps, the numbers that we have are the wiretaps placed by investigative authorities, not by Secret Service. And the problem with all these centralized services is that you can still be under review no matter how good the data protection directive is. I think we need to educate people even more than just getting the civil rights right. I mean, I think we should do that, definitely.
Well, I was just interrupting Steph, so before responding to that remark, let's allow Steph to continue what you're saying.
Okay, so then the laws in Europe are not so good, you say?
At the end of the day, well, that's one of the interesting parts of the data protection review. So far, the criminal investigations have always been outside the scope of the data protection directive. Basically, if it's part of justice departments, police work, etc., then the data protection directive is more or less does not apply anymore.
I recognize this deficit of this directive, but I also would point out that for commercial usage, the restrictions are much, much stricter, I guess.
In theory, yes.
In theory.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, the worst fine you can get is €40,000 in the Netherlands, yes, and that you can get for not notifying that you process data. And
yes, that is really a joke. I think the price of leaking private data should be higher.
I do agree with that bit, definitely. And that's the reason I was playing a bit of the devil's advocate. I don't think we're that much better off in Europe. Sorry, what were you saying, Steph?
You are very good at playing the devil's advocate, sir.
Even when not paid to do so, basically.
I do agree that, we're not better off in Europe. I mean, WikiLeaks is a specific case, and it has pissed off the United States. But, I mean, some other case could break down in Europe with the same strength. And I think that if you control your own server and if you run your own StatusNet instance, you choose where the logs go. And if you send the logs to instant deletion, then there are no logs to hand over to the authorities. And data retention directive does not apply to running a server like that. So there is, as long as we control the servers, we control the log files. And I think that the less log files we have, I mean, then these subpoenas become obsolete.
Yes, I completely agree. And I think this also, we need to point out that in this case, you are not trusting on a third party if you're hosting things on your own server. So I think this is also really important that whenever there is a third party, there can be some pressure applied on it and it will cooperate with the authorities.
But that's not feasible for consumers until the Freedom Box comes around with all the wonderful killer apps, etc. But since it's part of Debian, we shouldn't hold our breath, probably.
I am dreaming about having the time to start working on this.
Another problem with the Twitter is that people want to be on Twitter because everyone is on Twitter. This is the same effect that Facebook has.
Yeah, network effects. I mean, yes. I'm on Diaspora, not on Facebook, but it's pretty lonely on Diaspora.
Indeed.
Well, the name itself says it all. You need to be on Facebook. We need to have an alternative infrastructure that basically supports... It supports being in touch with other people, but the networking part is part that will be subject to subpoena, I'm afraid, for the time yet to come. So this will remain kind of a problem. The interesting question is why did they subpoena Twitter? Because I think it's kind of ignorant to think that there would be anything interesting in Rob's Twitter account.
Well, some people have interesting private messages, and they have probably been subpoenaing about everyone, everything under the sun in the United States about these people.
Yes, and you cannot expect that this is only Twitter. There might be other service providers that have been also affected, but they didn't talk about the order.
Of course, at least what I expect is Skype, definitely. You know, they will go for all the environmental data, and that makes it an interesting case.
Yes, it will be interesting to see what Skype has to say about this.
Well, at least two of you are on Skype. So, hello again, guys, those listening in.
Well, yeah, exactly. And that is a huge part of the problem. And then we've got another problem. As soon as an indictment is written, basically Rob Gongrijp is fucked.
Why do you think so?
Because there will be little... from a legal perspective, there's little you can do to prevent extradition to the U.S.
Yeah, that's interesting indeed. So far, the Netherlands has been stupid enough to extradite its own citizens to the United States.
Well, we have got no option because we are in a treaty. So even if we were to campaign now to have the treaty overthrown, that's all too late, you know?
This case is much more politicized than the previous case of the ecstasy dealing DJ. So I'm not quite as pessimistic as you are, but fairly pessimistic. And maybe I should move to Belgium. They have no government. That is helpful.
That is definitely helpful, but then I would go to the French part of the government because the Flemish speaking will be part of the Netherlands really soon, I think.
It's really time for music now.
Yeah.
Not very known for being very punctual. All of my friends know better than to show up right on time. I wanna be what you wait for before going on with your night. You know you love it when I come staggering in with my long list of lies. Before you know what has hit you, you'll be so.
I do not. un vêtement chaud, un pullover pour fillette. Fillette. Il y a bien longtemps que je ne fais plus dans la fillette. Parce que là, j'ai peut-être votre affaire.
Gobelet.
Just listen to I Only Care About You When You're Gone by the American artist Leslie Hunt from her album Your Hair Is On Fire, which is quite lovely actually. And the slightly less mainstream stuff you heard afterwards was Joble Rock Rider by the 462nd Zinnias from their album Rentrer dans l'Insecte. And we're back to our virtual studio, and we're going to have a bit of airtime for Brenno, because Brenno can't wait to speak about this court case. Brenno, floor is yours.
Gee. Well, it's maybe in if you compare to WikiLeaks, all very small, but it's kind of related, also about access to documents and what happens in the Netherlands when you ask it, that some cities have the opinion that they can charge you money for it. And in several cases, the court denied that. But in one case, the city basically tried to withdraw the case. And by the point that you have to withdraw the case yourself, they reinstated the fee. And that is a very mean trick that legally is very doubtful. So I countered that yesterday in court by stating, look, what you are doing is basically a violation of my civil rights, and more specifically, the freedom of speech. And this is something you can't do. And the logical consequence should be that they should.
Oh dear, it seems we have lost Brenno.
Sort of. It's the computer acting up again.
It's probably Linux again. Shall we play some music in the meantime? I would suggest.
You don't want to learn.
Selon les principes de l'Ayurveda, tout dans l'univers est médicinal. Connaissance de la vie dans sa globalité. Le microcosme, le corps humain ou tous les êtres vivants, et le macrocosme autour de nous font partie de la même entité. Le rôle du médecin est d'organiser les échanges entre le macrocosme et le microcosme. Il va préparer des substances que le corps peut facilement assimiler. C'est son rôle. Il ne fait qu'apporter au corps des éléments extérieurs pour combler des carences. Voilà, résumé brièvement, les principes ou l'approche de la médecine ayurvédique.
You just listened to Médecine Naturelle by David Elbrun from his album Trip with Water, and he's French as well. Why do the French make so much Creative Commons music, I sometimes think. Anyway, this was a stopgap measure because we lost Brenno. Brenno, you're back again on the show. Welcome, and do carry on.
Yeah, I don't know what you heard for the last, because I kept on ranting.
You were explaining that you were involved in a court case about the Freedom of Information Act, a request of yours, in which at last minute some fees which were requested from you and which you're contesting in court were reinstated by the municipality you were asking this from.
Yes, and in the Dutch legal system, it's not done, and then basically it's highly doubtful if you can do it. And as the judge made very explicit that she sincerely doubted that the case could even go on because of that error they made. And then the second thing, of course, is that you may have an expectation that if the government says, like, okay, the fees are gone, that they're really gone. And that is one of the obstacles. But I countered by asking for money for all the time lost and the traveling and the whole bullshit that they gave me because of this whole case. And I backed that by claiming that I have a right to gather information based on the European Declaration of Human Rights. So that's what I did. And now the judge is thinking about that. I had a feeling that it wasn't without a good chance, but you never know in court. It might go all the ways, but the city wasn't helping themselves by behaving like a total arse as they did.
Well, interesting, and the reason we brought this in was because this is also relevant to Freedom of Information Acts, which may be useful to get into more open data from governments. And Steph, you're a bit involved in that as well, aren't you?
Oh, yes, I am. There are a lot of things going on all across Europe. This is really exciting things. One of the most prominent one is the Open Knowledge Foundation from the UK. They're deeply involved with data.gov UK, which is an awesome site to browse data. And last year, in I think it was November, the British government decided that they will lay open all contracts and all financial data pertaining to any kind of public contracting. And for municipalities, this will be anything above £500.
So this is really exciting. That it gives a great deal of transparency. And I think this is really exciting to see in Britain. The minister responsible for this, the cabinet minister, even demands for a right to data, so that it is a fundamental right of the citizens of the British Commonwealth to access all this data, and that this should be provided. I think this is really exciting. And similar Steph? Things are going off all across Europe. Another really exciting organization Steph? Is mysociety.org. Yes, sir?
I would like to interrupt you for a second because you're making a very interesting point there on all this money that government spends. Yesterday in court, one of the things I said, like, this city ordered a website for 200,000 euros, which is a shitload of money. And I said, like, well, I would love to investigate it, but if they send me bills, it's too expensive for me to investigate. And then I pointed out that you could do it with open source software for a lot less money. And then they called me a sorrow person for saying that, which is really funny, because now you're telling me exactly that is exactly what happens in Germany. So that's
no,
interesting.
It's the British Commonwealth in the UK.
Okay, but still, you know, that is very interesting, because then
but
people can respond
Germany,
to it like you're spending too much money on this.
Yes, this is really important, and this would be really helpful in determining this, and I think it would also break down a lot of costs in government. This is I think a really important step that the British government is doing here, but also the other things like access to data all around, that is pertaining to public funding and governmental issues like plumbing data or things that are really, really common and do not involve private data. That is really an important issue that we should really care about. Also that when all these open government initiatives are launched, that we need to have an eye for privacy all the time, because I think it's to no one's benefit if suddenly health care records are completely public. Of course, this is kind of radical, but we can expect other things that might impede privacy rights, which we should be careful and watchful for in these open government initiatives. And then, of course, with open government initiatives, there's the other end of the spectrum. There's freedom of information requests, because usually what we understand with open government data is large-scale data sets. Whereas when we are talking about freedom of access information, we are talking about like information what is happening at Guantanamo, really targeted information that might be really seriously secret, or in some cases it should be still known by the public. So freedom of access information, access requests are also very important.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, but that I think is a very obvious one.
Yeah, okay.
Chris, any thoughts from Sweden on the subject of freedom of information, act requests, open data, government transparency?
Well, I see something very interesting.
Brenna, I was asking Chris.
Oh, freedom of information. I mean, Sweden historically has a Freedom of Information Act from the 1700s or something like that, which states that any government or official organization needs to make their documents public upon request. And of course, so we have had a very long discussion about the relation between privacy on the one hand and then transparency on the other hand. So I think that I do agree that there is a huge risk when it comes to the privacy of my health journals or my confidential information with, let's say, psychiatry or whatever. But I think that, I mean, we are already well prepared for something, a process that may come from the outside. I mean, let's say that there is a leaking site or similar that displaces these already established norms for the relation between privacy and transparency. So I hope that the responsibility lies with us in the kind of the hacker or activist communities as well. That we, when we start making new leak sites beyond WikiLeaks, then of course we have an obligation and a responsibility to do this in a very in a good way. Because with the internet and with this technology that we know, there comes a power, and with power comes responsibility, of course.
Obviously. Gentlemen, I'm going to thank you very much for being on the show, because we are nearing the end of it. Some final thoughts, Brenna, on this? The balance between privacy and open data?
Actually, Sweden was the first country. I want to respond first to Sweden real quick. It was the first country with the FOIA in 1766. And it was also the first country that has an exemption rule for privacy. I know that because I sometimes use the Swedish route to get to information. And it is an issue, but it is also in, I think, all relevant countries exempt. So I'm not really worried about that too much, like getting health records data, because under European law that is very unlikely to happen. It's very interesting to see that what's happening in the UK, because all of a sudden, if you're a company and you want to do business with the government, you apparently have to learn to live with transparency, and that's very interesting.
Okay, thank you. And Steph, Chris, it was wonderful to have you on the show. We're closing with the song Game Over by Pornophonique from its album 8-Bit Lagerfeuer.
She has taken all my life. She gave me good times, she gave me bad times, and then she gave me her goodbye. And there's no heart inside of her, she is just a slot machine, the most golden evil zombie bitch that I have ever seen. My game is over, I'm not a lover. Before, so I beg for mercy, for an extra ball to play. One more life, only one more life, to fix the trouble on my way. My game is over, I'm not a lover, I'm not a lover anymore. She said sorry, now she told me that I'm not even in her high score. Forever and ever, no more together, such a vain. We'll be right back.
assistance.
We get signal, main screen turn on. You're listening to the radio program about